How about we don't try and make food perfect? Because it's not perfect, just like life's not perfect.
If you're recycling, that's awesome. But you also need to look at all these other pieces, and you don't have to be doing them perfectly.
The first step is reduce, then reuse, then recycle. They are in order.
Get inspired by people fighting to make this world better for everyone. This is Unwasted with Imperfect.
Hello and welcome back to the Unwasted podcast. I'm your host, Riley Brock, and it's my honor every week to talk with experts in food, health, sustainability, and generally making the world a better, tastier place. Now, like a lot of you, I've been really missing restaurants this year, and while I'm doing my best to support my local restaurants by ordering takeout and delivery when I'm burnt out on cooking, it doesn't really recreate the full experience of going to a restaurant and the magic you can get at a restaurant. So I've been doing a lot of thinking recently about, why do I miss this experience so much, and what about it am I really missing out on? You know, there's something so nice about sitting down at a restaurant, having somebody else cook for you. You know, this is especially true on some of our favorite special occasions. And so to do a little thought experiment, I'd like you to close your eyes and imagine you're eating at a fine dining restaurant for a special occasion. Now, what cuisine are they cooking? French, Italian, Spanish, New American? Why not Ghanaian, Nigerian, or Ethiopian food? Which cuisines do we choose to elevate, and which do we sideline or leave out of the conversation entirely? Now, today's guest is Kes Ashun, a Ghanaian chef and pastry chef who makes a living creating magical meals that weave together her memories of growing up in Ghana with her culinary journey here in America. And she's here to share her delicious take on modern African cuisine with us. Kes Ashun, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here today. First of all, I should have asked earlier, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, Kes Ashun, anything goes.
Okay,
good.
Cool. I always like to be sensitive about names. I know people, it's near and dear.
Yeah, I'm good.
Amazing. So Kes, I'd like to start with a little bit about your background. You know, where did you grow up and how did your upbringing shape your relationship to food?
So I grew up in Ghana. And I came over to the States to go to college. And growing up, I literally live in the kitchen. I saw my mom. We cook every day, breakfast, lunch, dinner. Our maid goes to the market every day. Or when we go to the village or our hometown, I saw my grandmom just go to the farm, bring the produce fresh daily. You know, we make our own milk. And so when I move up here and I got married and with kids, I try to instill that in them. So I don't buy anything. I actually make everything from scratch because that's how I grew up. And cooking was a thing. We cook every couple of hours in a day. You know, in 24 hours, I think we cook like four times. In 24 hours. So I think that shaped my passion to be a chef. Yeah,
it sounds like it was woven quite literally into every single day. You know, what are some of your earliest memories around food?
Oh, cooking with family, and especially my mom and my grandmom. And I hear them tell me stories about their mother and their grandmom. And, you know, I learned a lot from my mom and my grandmother through cooking, you know, because that's when we have a conversation.
Yeah.
So I learned how to season different protein. You know, there's a seasoning that brings out the flavor of poultry. There's different herbs or spices that bring the flavor of beef and fish. And, you know, so that's where I learned most of my culinary skills.
Yeah, is from your mom and grandma. And, you know, today you have a spice line of your own. Is that right? At Kes Cravings?
Yes, yes, yes. And that actually, you know, just my bringing up, because my grandmother told me there's nothing like all purpose. You know, you don't, every season does not work for every, produce or a protein. You know, there are like seasoning or herbs. Like I would not make any poultry without anise seed and basil. Those two belongs together. And those two. Yes, especially basil.
Yeah. For chicken.
Any poultry, yes, for chicken. So, and that's why I have my poultry seasoning for, you know, duck, guinea fowl, turkey. It works on all those poultry. And then I have seasoning that works for like vegetables or seafood, beef, and all that stuff. Yeah, so that's how my spices came about, because, you know, I started using it at home and at my pop-ups, and I get a lot of questions like, what do you put in your food? What do you use? And I'm like, it's just natural spices and, you know, herbs. I do not use food enhancers or those bouillons and all those Maggi cube. I don't use those things. Because I believe if you need a food enhancer to make your food taste good, then you can cook.
Yeah. So it seems like that kind of from scratch mentality, that's something you learned from a super young age from your mom and your grandma.
Very, very, very young age, from scratch and very few ingredients. It doesn't have to be expensive, but it has to be quality, you know, straight from the farm. You know, in the city, in my house, we have a garden there. We have plantain, banana, taro leaves, which is similar to spinach. And we just pluck it right from there, bring it to the kitchen and cook. I mean, it's right from, not even from farm to table, it's from the backyard to the table.
Yeah.
And so that's how I grew up. And I move up here and I still do the same thing. I'll buy a whole chicken up to date. I still buy a whole chicken and fabricate it myself because I need the bones for my stocks. And I don't buy stocks because there's so much ingredients in there and very high sodium.
Yeah.
But you can actually use the bones to make your stocks. And also, even after just cooking it, the little pieces of the meat that get left on the bone, I pull it and place it in a bowl until I get a huge, you know, a good amount to make like a slider or a pulled chicken or pulled pork or whatever. You just add some sauce to it and makes it very juicy, and you can stick it into any bread. And there you have it. So the whole fowl, you getting three things out of it, basically.
Yeah, I like that whole chicken and zero waste mentality. That's so important.
No, I even if you pay me, I cannot waste food. I mean, I cannot. I will still sneak it and hide it somewhere. I will not waste it. You know, just I still buy whole pineapple because when I cut it, the skin, I add hibiscus, I add lemon to it. I add some spices to it. Alligator peppers and other spices to it and boil it. So instead of drinking, how do you call it? This vinegar, apple cider vinegar that people drink in the morning. That was what I was drinking when I was a child. And up to date, I still have one on my stove and my kids drink it. So after I peel the pineapple, I wash it, add it in a bowl, add water, add lemon peel, orange peel, hibiscus hibiscus flowers, and some spices.
Yeah.
And just boil it. And we drink it every morning. And then my kids will enjoy the pineapple fruit. And then the core, the pineapple core, I slice it and use it as a skewer when I'm grilling like shrimp or fish. You know, you need something soft and you need to poke a hole into the meat to kind of stick the pineapple's core in. But when it hits the grill or fire, because there's sugar, it caramelizes and it tastes amazing.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I do that to sugarcane. I don't know if you've seen the real sugarcane. It's a tall. Yeah. You know, growing up, we will extract the juice out of it and my mom will dry it. And so we use it to smoke fish or meat and it gives it a whole different flavor to it.
Wow.
So wasting is not in my genes. It's just, I can't waste anything.
Yeah. So that kind of fresh zero waste mentality, that's been part of your life since a young age. And then, you know, when you decided to become a professional chef, you know, really do this full time, you know, what was that journey like? How did you make that decision and who kind of mentored or taught you along the way?
Well, it's very interesting. So I wanted to cook at a very, very young age. And so when I moved up here to go to college, I told my parents, I wanted to go to culinary school. And my mom was like, "Can't you cook, girl?" I said, "I can cook, but it's not that kind of cooking."
Yeah.
No, they were like, no, you better go do some, you know, African parents want you to be a doctor, a nurse, a lawyer, accountant, you know. So my first degree is actually computer science. And I hated it.
Really? What didn't you like about it?
Just sitting down and programming. It wasn't my thing. I just wanted to cook. And I'm the one that would go to class very late with snacks. You know, I come in and I have snacks to give. And the room starts to smell like, what is that? But I did it anyway for them. And I was still missing something. So I went ahead and I got my master's, you know, my MBA.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I want to run my own business. So this will help me. So one day I was going to the grocery store and I drove past the culinary school and I enrolled in the culinary school. But when I got there, there was two things. I know I can cook because learning from my aunties, my mom, my grandmother, I wanted to know more about baking, the science behind baking, because there's chemistry and, you know, science behind baking. I wanted to pull sugar. I wanted to sculpt chocolate and stuff like that. So I was like, okay, maybe I should do pastry because I know I can cook. Yeah. And, you know, with cooking, you can wing a lot of things, but with baking, you have to measure and know the science behind what you're doing. And you have to have patience. And that's one thing I have. So let me go through that route. And culinary school was like a refresher course to me.
Yeah.
Because I started still cooking and hosting events and baking cakes and stuff like that for people. And I realized that, you know, I need that paper to back whatever I talk about or, you know, whatever I'm doing. So I don't know if you've heard this saying that the cook knows how, but the chef knows why.
Yeah.
So to me, I went to culinary school to learn the whys.
Yeah.
Why I'm making this sauce, why I need to thicken this, why I have to make this roux very dark, you know. And my mother was making roux to add to sauces at a very young age. And I don't even think she knew that it was called roux, but she was doing it.
Yeah.
You know, some techniques that they teach us in culinary school, I saw my mom do it, you know. Fold the spinach and kind of chiffonade it, you know, so that it can be fluffy for garnishing. She was doing that, but she was just doing it because I think she learned it from the grandmother or, you know,
yeah,
without her knowing. So when I went to culinary school, it was like, oh, this is a refresh. Oh, okay. That is why we do this. You know, when I'm making a buttercream, and it breaks, I can save it because I know the chemistry behind why it's curdling or why it's broken.
Yeah.
Compared to somebody who doesn't know that might just trash it. And again, that's waste right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. I mean, I spent some time on your Instagram looking at your pastry creations and they're truly mind-blowingly beautiful and well put together. You have such a wealth of pastry knowledge. I think, you know, it sounds like you kind of honed that in professional kitchens and culinary school, but it sounds like it's been there for a while. I'd love to hear, what are some kind of chef tips, you know, that why you're talking about? What are some chef tips for better desserts you think home cooks should know about?
Oh, one is for when you're making like pies and scones and biscuits, the butter has to be extra cold. I mean, I will put it in the freezer.
Yeah.
Just put it in the freezer, toss it into your flour and grate it. Because when you're making those pies, you want those flaky, you know, you want it to melt in your mouth. And I quite sometimes see people overwork a dough for like a scone or a pie crust. And I'm like, oh my God, why are you doing that? You know, just put it together. And even if it starts melting, put it back in the fridge or the freezer and then bring it out again. You just make sure it is very cold. Yeah. With that, you're going to get a very flaky crust. And also, I do use vodka instead of water. Because when the alcohol evaporates, it's very flaky.
Whoa.
And, you know, people say, oh, I don't drink, but the alcohol goes away. There's no alcohol in it afterwards. Yeah. It just leaves flavor.
Yeah.
You know, and when you're making cakes, on the other hand, it has to be room temperature, at least an hour or two on the counter. And I see a lot of people when they add, you know, they cream the butter, sugar and all that. Then they add the flour in there and they keep mixing. Oh, no, your cake is going to be so hard. And, you know, because when you start mixing the flour, you start to develop gluten.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so don't overmix your pancake. Don't overmix your cake batter and make sure your butter is extra, extra cold when you're making your pie crust, biscuits, scones and all that. Anything that you want that extra flakiness, make sure the butter is cold.
This is super helpful. I'm definitely taking notes from my own baking. Okay, so it sounds like one, don't overmix your desserts, right? Because mixing develops glutens and glutens make stuff chewy. So if you want it to be flaky or light, you cannot overmix.
No.
And then for the butter, you want it cold. Is it so you can get big chunks? Because that'll be how you can flake it? Or why is it you want it so cold?
When it's cold, it's not going to melt. And I usually will grate it.
Yeah.
Use a grater to grate it. Because you have these little chunks in the butter. And that's when it gets into the oven, it melts. And when you break into it, you can see the butter melted away. So then there's the little space or whatever. That's, you know, you see that flaky, like different layers. And then with pancakes too, a lot of people just overmix pancake. Pancakes, it's good to have little lumps in there.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, you can mix waffle a little bit. But with pancakes, just mix it until it comes together. And for a fluffy pancake, don't overmix pancake batter.
Yeah. Wow. That's super helpful. So pastry technique, you got down. You're blowing my mind over here, which is great. If in terms of savory stuff, you know, if you could give home cooks, let's say, three tips to improve their just home cooking, like breakfast, lunch, and dinner type of stuff, what would these tips be, do you think?
Okay, so an example, if you're making, like you're trying to sear a fish or chicken or whatever, make sure it's room temperature.
Yeah.
Do not take it out of the fridge and just season it or whatever and put it on in a pan. And your pan has to be hot. So it's going to dry out if it's not room temperature. Because, you know, you pan sear the chicken and sometimes it's very dry.
Yeah.
Because they take it right from the freezer and season it and sometimes just put it in the pan and the pan is not even hot enough. For me, I like a very flavorful meat or chicken or whatever. So I'll take chicken as an example. When I come home from the store, you know, I fabricate it and get all my pieces together, wash it, and I season it and I put it in a Ziploc.
Okay.
And I place it in the freezer. So while it's trying to get frozen, it's already marinating. And then when you take it out, when you need it, it's going to sit in the fridge for maybe a couple of hours. I don't know if you're going to work and you come back home to cook or whatever, while it's thawing, it's still marinating.
Yeah.
So when you cook that chicken, it has so much flavor. And again, as I said from the beginning, chicken or poultry, onions, garlic, ginger, bay leaf, basil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just blend it and put it together. I have an app on iTunes with some recipes, and I have a YouTube channel with a few recipes until Corona happened, but I'll get back to it. and prepping.
Yeah.
Prepping. I think I learned that in culinary school, and it has helped me so much. So when I have time, I blend some marinade, label it, date it, and put it in a freezer. When I go to the farmer's market, there's a lot of tomatoes. I bring it home, wash it, add some bell peppers, some ginger, roast it, blend it, kind of make a stew out of it, and freeze it. I have bucket and bucket full of stewed tomatoes in my... I never use canned tomato, never.
Really?
No. I always have extra. And I try to measure all my ingredients, make sure it's at one place, which is mise en place, you know, in culinary school. And it's kind of like, it's sometimes like, oh, it's too much work, but it saves so much time.
Yeah. If you do it ahead of time.
If you do ahead of time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
timing matters for sure. Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, because we don't have time.
Yeah.
And so I already have my marinade. I bring the chicken from the store. I wash it. I pour the marinade on it back into the freezer. I'm done.
Yeah.
You know, my tomato is already stewed. It has already reduced to half. If I'm going to make like a stew or whatever, steam my meat, you know, broil it or whatever you're doing, even grilled chicken, you just add your stew. It's already cooked.
Yeah.
It saves so much time. So I prep ahead is one of my big things that saves me a lot of time at home. And, you know, when I'm hosting events, it's a time saver. That's one of the best things I learned in culinary school, just prep ahead.
Yeah. 100%. So you're doing that kind of chopping, making your sauces, marinating your meat. You do all that ahead of time. So when it comes time to cook, it's just quick, put stuff together, heat it up, ready to go. Yeah.
Quick.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to dig into that a little bit more, because that's something we hear a ton from customers at Imperfect, honestly, is like the biggest obstacle between them and cooking more often or cooking healthier or making special meals for their friends and family is time. People never feel like they have enough time, and we're all busy folks. I think that's just a reality, but I'd love to hear more, just, you know, kind of what, as a chef, like, how do you go about saving time, and what are some ways that folks at home can save time in their cooking?
Well, you know, I hear this a lot, and people tell me, how do you get time to do this? Well, you are on Facebook for 2 hours. You know, you can make a bread while you're on Facebook, you know, because when you mix the bread for 15 minutes, it needs to prove for 1 hour, you can go back to what you're doing on social media. And then you come and roll it for another 15 minutes and you let it prove for another hour.
Yeah.
And you can go back. And I make my bread. I have 3 kids. I have 3 boys.
Yeah.
So I make it and I freeze it. And trust me, the freezer is my best friend. Hmm. When you freeze bread, or a lot of the baked goods, it comes out fresh.
Yeah.
So you even pancakes and waffle, I make them and I freeze them, especially waffle for my kids.
Uh-huh.
Just make the batter, freeze it, and they can put it in a toast. Or you can even mix your pancake. Don't add the liquid to it.
Yeah.
But you have your baking powder and salt and stuff like that. And just label it. I'm a big labeler. I have all kinds of containers. Label and date and put in your pantry. So when you're ready, you just get your buttermilk or milk or whatever liquid you're adding to it and toss it together, you know, and that will save you time. And again, I talk about my tomatoes. I even cut onions ahead.
Yeah.
and just put it in a container, just like we do in the restaurant. I mean, that's the only way. We go in the morning and we prep for service.
Yeah.
You know, you can even cook your meat or, you know, your protein. You can confit. That's one of my favorite things to do, because the oil that I use to confit my meat is so flavorful. I will use it to fry chicken. I will use it to saute vegetables and all kinds of stuff.
So for folks that don't know, confit is cooking submerged in oil, right?
In oil. Yeah. In oil. And I season whatever I'm doing and, you know, I cook it and it's very slow. So the oil is not cooking to like maybe 500 degrees or whatever.
So yeah, it's very gentle, right?
Very gentle, slow. And, you know, the chicken will look white, but it's cooked. You just have to pan sear it to give it color.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes what we do in the restaurant. So the chicken comes out really hot and, you know, we're not just cooking it right there. Yeah. I do not wait. When I'm doing laundry, I am cooking something. I am proofing something. I am mixing something. When I'm folding, I am mixing something. It's we tend not to have time, but we do have time.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes where we are spending our time on, and especially with the social media, you can spend 8 hours on there.
Yeah, if you're not careful.
If you're not careful.
Yeah.
But you can, and then you talk about you don't have time, you know.
Yeah.
And busy it moms.
Like, sorry, go ahead.
I said busy moms, you know, you can do things ahead. I've got my kids to, you know, you have to train them anyway. So they weigh ingredients for me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I weigh things in grams because it's the best.
Metric system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, they weigh things for me. So I give them the recipe and I tell them, read the recipe and to know what you actually even, what I'm about to cook.
Yeah.
And then weigh everything down for me.
Yeah.
So while I'm busy folding or ironing or doing something else, they are measuring it for me. And I've trained them to the point that, you know, like my 11-year-old makes bread in the house.
Hmm. So your kids are involved in the cooking. They're active in the kitchen while
they're
you're
active. Yeah.
Okay.
And I find that they eat the food because they think they're being part of it. Oh, they're cooking, you know.
Yeah.
So we make pizza dough and I freeze the pizza dough. And so when it's time for pizza, I take it out, it thaws, and I tell them, spread it out and put your vegetables and whatever on there. They love it because they think they're making their own pizza. And that's another way to get the kids to eat more and know that, you know, just eat at home.
Yeah.
That's how my kids eat. Because when they know that they made it themselves, they are happy. They are eating something they made, you know. So include them, let them help, you know. You know, just teach them how to use the knife skills so they don't cut themselves. You know, a grown up, my 8-year-old will peel the green beans and the little tip. You know, just give them the appropriate job to do in the kitchen.
Yeah.
With the food, and it will cut the time that you sit in the kitchen doing whatever, because somebody already cut the onions for you, or somebody already peel the potatoes or, you know, stuff like that for you. And I blanch a lot of my vegetables and put it in the fridge. So when it's time to make a fried rice or some sauteed vegetable, it's already cooked.
You're just trying
to hit it through, you know, and that's all part of prepping ahead of time.
Yeah.
And it makes eating very easy and you can eat a home cooked meal. Yes, I do go out and eat, well, before Corona, but 99% of the time I'm eating at home and I try new things and we try new recipes, you know, to make it fun.
Yeah.
I don't waste anything. Yeah. I don't buy ice cream.
Yeah.
Because I make buttercream, Swiss meringue buttercream, which is egg white, sugar, and butter. So after that, I use the egg white, the yolk, I make ice cream with it. And you just need milk and cream and the eggs and some sugar or some condensed milk, or you can puree dates. For the vegan, you can use coconut milk. I grew up, my mom made her own coconut milk. When we go to the village, my grandmother was making her own tiger nut milk. So I still do that here.
Yeah. As a mother of three, so the time is there, people. You can find it. You just gotta be a little scrappy about it. I mean, I love what you said about, it sounds kind of your, part of your approach is you're layering. So you'll like start something, then go do something else, then come back to the thing you started. And I mean, that's something I worked in kitchens for a couple of years, and that's something I definitely learned as well, that the key to getting through a really dense to-do list is knowing what stuff you can do while other stuff is going. Like any task is divided between active time and passive time. And so, you know, while you're chopping that onion, you know, there's something simmering on the stove, there's something roasting in the oven, maybe there's even something in the microwave, there's something thawing in the sink. Like you layer all your different tasks. And it sounds like that's a big way you're finding all these efficiencies as a working woman and a mother of three. You're still making all this food basically from scratch because you're very deliberate about when and how you do all the different parts.
Yeah. And a traveling husband, well, before Corona.
Yeah.
You wow. know, and it's crazy, but I find time, and I tell people you can if you try, because mm-hmm. if you're making short ribs, it's in the oven cooking like 3 hours.
Yeah.
You're not standing there and watching the meat cook.
I mean, hopefully not. Yeah.
You can do something else. And if it's done ahead and it's in the freezer or in the fridge, that means you don't have to think about that. You know, I still, my kids still have breakfast in the morning, and sometimes they having waffle and bacon, and my friends are like, how do you get up like 5 a.m.? It's done. I did it maybe on Sunday, and on Monday they are eating waffles because they just have to put it in a toaster.
Yeah.
And when I buy fruits, I do a lot of organic fruits if I'm going to eat it, you know, anything that I'm going to eat raw, I try to buy organic.
Yeah.
And it goes bad so fast, but with raspberry, strawberry and stuff like that, you can make jam with it. You can make a compote with it and you can freeze it. It doesn't go bad. And I have this ice cream base that is already done. Hey, today we're going to have some raspberry ice cream. I'm just taking the raspberry that I've cooked down and stir it into the ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
And they're happy.
Yeah.
You have peaches, you have orange, you know, the orange peel, if I don't add it to my pineapple and my other stuff on the stove to drink in the morning, I'm making a confit pineapple or orange peel. I can add into a cake. I can mix it into my buttercream. You know, there's so many things you can do with it and not waste it.
Yeah. Can I share an observation or a theory I have about food with you?
Sure.
So I have this theory that I'm curious your take on this. I think there's two groups of people that are meal prepping what I would consider the right way, or at the very least, like the most efficient way. One is folks like you, folks that are either in the industry or people like me who have been in the industry. So like they know on some level, like this is the efficient way to, you know, chop, store, label, date, par cook, all these little restaurant hacks and tricks. The other group is this interesting confluence of like fitness people, like people that are really into exercise, right, are often getting up really early. They really value clean eating. And so they're also, you know, prepping, labeling, dating, cooking stuff ahead of time, batch cooking. And so there's these two kind of niche groups of like fitness enthusiasts and either current or former restaurant people that are, I would say, doing things kind of the right way, or like they got the right mindset about saving time in the kitchen. And my thought is, like, we just need to find a way to get everyone in the middle to also adopt at least some of these principles, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And it's, I think people need to start, okay, let's have a home cooked meal once a week, yeah, at least. And then you can go twice a week. You know, you have to start small, because a lot of people think cooking is hard. For me, it's a passion. I love doing it. So I don't see it as hard. But some people just, you know, don't want to be bad at it. You know, I have clients that will call me that they want like fried calamari. And I'm like, really? No, I'm not going to do that for you. I'll give you the recipe. It is so easy. You know, they're like, I don't want to be bad at it. I understand, but I'm like, can you try? At least I have the recipe for you. Just try. And yeah, so I think people should start with once a week, you know, twice a week. Today I'm going to make bread. I'm going to try, find a recipe and try on some bread.
Yeah.
Like an Italian bread, something very easy. You know, and when I go to the store and I look at the bread and I see 15 ingredients on there, and you have the bread in the house for 3 weeks and it does not mold, I ask myself, what's in this bread?
Yeah.
Because when I make my bread in 3 days, if it's not in the freezer, it's molding.
Yeah.
Oh, and another thing, I always, do not put bread in the fridge. Hmm. Either in the freezer or room temperature.
Why is that?
It becomes so hard.
Yeah. The fridge, I mean, I hear you and agree with you. I think the fridge is a remarkably hostile place for food. I think we think about the fridge as really friendly because it keeps some stuff fresh longer. But the reality is it's a very, like, it dehydrates food remarkably fast because it's like all this kind of cold, dry air moving around in there. So if you throw, like I've noticed, if you throw a head of chard or kale or lettuce or greens in there, and there's no covering, it will wilt in a matter of hours just from the air circulating around it. So the fridge is not always your friend.
No, but you know something, growing up in, you know, in the city with my parents, the only thing I remember we had in the fridge was water.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I did not grow up... like leftover food was not a thing. We cook every day.
Wow.
So when there's fish in season, we fermenting it, we curing it, we smoking it, we drying it.
Yeah.
Because in Africa, in Ghana, there's a lot of things are seasonal.
Yeah.
So when the mango is in season, we are trying to save it.
Yeah.
Because when it's not in season and you're craving for it, you want some. The fish, we smoke it, we dry it, we ferment it and all that stuff. So I still remember the only thing you find in the fridge is water. We cook and the leftover, you can always find people to give to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great way to prevent waste in my book is generosity, right?
Yeah. And my mom was... given, we, you know, we'll cook and there's extra, and my dad is like, okay, what's this extra for? Oh, somebody's hungry on the street. Somebody's gonna be hungry on the street. Yeah. She'll just walk outside and find somebody to give the food to them, you know, not gonna trash it. Mm-mm.
Yeah,
never. Yeah, but we cook every single day. I think that's one of the things that got me doing this too, because I don't know anything different from that, you know. No processed food. I don't do the baking. I buy once in a while the uncured one, and I sometimes cure my own meat. I use celery juice and salt, and it does the same job.
Yeah, because celery has natural nitrates in it, right?
Yes. So that's what I do when I want to cure some meat or, you know, I dry. I have a smoker here. I smoke my fish and it's dry and I keep it in the freezer and it can last for a long time.
Yeah.
When I go to the store and it's in season or it's cheap, you know, I just like, oh, I'm going to buy a whole box and I'm going to work on it. And, yeah. You know, up till now, I still will scale my fish myself. I just get it, bring it home. Like shrimp, I make sure I get with the scale because I'm going to make stock out of it.
Yeah, you
when
make
I'm
safe
making
and stock.
Soup,
yeah.
Yes, when I'm making soup, I'm making rice. I don't use water. I have a lot of stocks, you know, ready there that will give it more flavor. And that's one thing that gives restaurant food, makes it so flavorful because we use stock a lot.
Yeah.
So I can't waste anything. I don't know how to do that. Yeah. I'm always trying to save something.
Yeah. So, I mean, in addition to one being a heroic mother of three who's cooking all this stuff for your boys, which is awesome in its own right, you're also a working chef whose work in part seeks to bring African cuisine to a wider audience. I want to dig into that a bit. You know, let's start with your style. I've heard your style described as Afrofusion cuisine. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, so Afrofusion, or actually, it's kind of like a culinary bridge between African flavors and Western cuisine using French techniques.
Okay.
So when I cook, I make sure I use an ingredient from Africa, or I am inspired by my childhood memory. So I would take a street food that I used to eat when I was a little child, or some dish that, you know, I love to eat, you know, when I was growing up, or like, you know, a street food, and I put a spin on it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you an example. So there's this dish called Red Red. It's made out of boiled beans. You boil the beans and you just add it to, you know, put it on a plate. You drizzle some palm oil on it and you fry plantain, you know, the yellow plantain, the banana's cousin, mm-hmm. you know. And first of all, there's like a vegan dish right there because there's no meat in there. But so I take that and I was, okay, I love Red Red. Now I want to put Red Red on a plate for my pop-up. So I will use the plantain and make a gnocchi out of it, which Whoa. Is Italian. But because I don't want to take the taste of the plantain out, I don't add flour to it. I have a technique of making the plantain very hard, and I just will pan sear it after I make the gnocchi out of it. Hmm. And then I'll boil the beans, stew it, and puree it, and make it, you know, it looks like a coulis. So it's very smooth. You know, put it on a plate. I'll deep fry some of the beans for the crunchy part. So now you have the beans, which is pureed, and you have the crunchy part, and you have the gnocchi, and I'll add some protein on top, and I'll garnish it. So when you come to my pop-up, I tell the people that are from Africa, the people that know the dish, they look at it and it's like, no, this is not African.
Yeah.
And I'm like, just close your eyes and taste it. That's the African dish you know.
Hmm.
And for those who are not from Africa, my non-African clients, they're like, is this plantain? This is just beans, you know? And they get surprised, this is African food. And I'm like, yeah, this is African food. Because when you talk of African food, people are thinking a heaping, you know, a lot of food on a plate. It doesn't look beautiful. And some people think it stinks. It's too spicy, you know. But my thing, how I actually even got started on this African fine dining and stuff is when I like going to the restaurant, you know, fine dining restaurant, and I get my plate and I look at my plate and I'm like, why can't African food be this? Why are we not plating African food like that? So a lot of people think I'm trying to change the taste or whatever. And I tell them, come to my pop-up. It tastes the same. It's just the look. I'm big on presentation. Mm-hmm. We eat with our eyes.
Yeah.
So just make the food taste good. So if you try a dish, plate a really nice, an African dish, and you go to another place, another event, and you see this dish hipped up all, you know, a hot mess. Once somebody says, oh, this is red, you're going to say, oh, I know this food. It is delicious. I don't care how it looks like, because I've seen it look beautiful. I'm going to eat it. But if it doesn't look presentable and it's not beautiful, are you even going to try it? First of all, it has to be appetizing for you to even try to dig in.
Yeah.
How I got started.
Yeah. I think especially if you didn't grow up eating it or if it's unfamiliar to you, I think, yeah, it sounds like part of what you're exploring in your pop-ups is you're challenging two groups of people, maybe the white audience that has never even had food like this. They need an entry point into what it is and how they understand it. And then the African audience who maybe hasn't seen it plated like this, they need to understand that this is still respectful and based in what they grew up eating, but that it's, you're riffing on it, you're exploring it, you're playing with it a bit.
Yes. And, you know, 6-7 years ago when I started, it's so hard, you know, the comment is like, why is she playing with her food? What is she doing? I'm not doing anything to it but presenting it, because I realized that my clients were not Africans.
Yeah.
And I found out that people really love our food, but how can we get them to taste it? I had a pop-up in Austin and it was 99% non-African.
Yeah.
And I made this African sauce and they were like, what is this? This is not marinara sauce. What is this sauce? And I'm like, you know something? There is a market for this. Yeah. So I'm going to capitalize on it. And so most of my guests are not Africans.
Yeah.
And they love the food. You know, is this African food? What did you put in it? I made a peanut, we have a peanut butter soup. You know, I had a guest ask, what kind of cream is in this? I said, there's no cream. It's just peanut, onions, garlic, ginger, and tomatoes. That's it. And it tastes so good, but they've not tasted it before. We do not market our cuisine. I mean, now it's getting better, but I'm yet to see an African restaurant, you know, Michelin star.
Yeah.
I'm yet. There's one, I think, a restaurant in France. The chef is from South Africa, but that's it.
Yeah. As you bring up two really interesting points for me off the bat. One is, obviously Africa is an enormous, really diverse continent. You know, just like when you talk about Chinese food, you're talking about really like dozens of different cuisines. When you talk about Indian food, you're talking about dozens of different cuisines. So when you talk about African food, obviously we're talking about so many different jumping off points, regions, cultures, climates, sets of ingredients. Yes. But it's always struck me that African food is widely underrepresented in the U.S., like, you know, where I live in the Bay Area, there's a lot of Ethiopian food, but that's about it. There's some, you know, you can find some West African food, but it's not nearly as well represented as Mexican food, Indian food, Italian food. It's always struck me as interesting. And obviously I'm a sample of one here, so I'm not like an expert on where African food is or isn't, but it's always struck me that is kind of a curious thing, that such a large region of the world is really underrepresented in a country that brands itself as a country of immigrants, you know?
Yes. And, you know, I don't know how my Africans are going to take this, but a lot of the African restaurants are not targeting the non-Africans.
Oh, interesting.
You know, and I'm saying, I don't know how they're going to take this, but it is true. So when you go in there, their target is not non-African. So how are you going to get them? And that's how I started, because, you know, with my business background, I did my research on my target market, and it's not Africans. My target is not Africans. It's non-Africans, well-traveled people, people that are not scared to try new things, you know. You know, those are my target, and, you know, I'm going for them. But if you open the restaurant and you are not targeting non-Africans, then how are they going to know about it? You know? Yeah.
I guess I should qualify my earlier remark, too, with it could very well be that there are African restaurants near me, but yeah, I am unaware of them, which I guess speaks to your point that on some level, either they're not for me or I'm just not discovering them, or it's this interesting disconnect, I guess.
And marketing.
We don't market.
Somebody said we need a big time PR team for African cuisine. Our food tastes so amazing. And even just in Ghana, just cooking in one region, I can make dishes from just one region without repeating a dish in a year.
Yeah.
And for my pop-up, have not repeated a dish.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you bringing that up too, because that's something I'm learning later in life. I think embarrassingly later in life is that so many of these, not even cuisines, but regions within a cuisine are way deeper than you as an outsider would know. And to your point, that yeah, you could just cook Ghanaian food for a whole year and probably not, it sounds like not repeat anything. Yeah.
Ghanaian, just one region.
Just one sub-region.
Just
yeah.
One. No, yes.
Totally. Yeah. That's a great point.
I'm still learning, you know, You know, I think last year I went to Ghana like 3 times and I create menu for this high-end restaurant, and they used to bring in a lot of produce and, you know, like carrots and stuff like that. And I asked myself, why? We have so much here that you guys are not making use of it. So I had to change all that. We have carrots. They want baby carrots. Peel the carrots, make it little, make it look like a baby carrot. And then use the scraps to make soup. You make stocks, you know.
Yeah.
Why are we getting in yellow peppers? It costs so much. Sometimes a whole steak dish, the most expensive thing on there is a yellow bell pepper, because we don't grow yellow bell pepper in Ghana. Mm-hmm. Why don't you use the green pepper that we grow in Ghana and do something else with it?
Interesting. So,
you know,
imported food is still like a big part of the cuisine, even though there's so much being grown there in Ghana, huh?
You know, so I changed the menu. We use what we have in Ghana, and we have so much that we don't use it. You know, I mean, we have so much. I don't know if you know what palm oil is.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, the palm tree itself, we get so many things out of it. We get the palm oil, we get a palm butter to make soup with it. The palm kernel itself, we make oil with it.
Mm-hmm.
And we use the leaves, we make a broom that you can sweep your kitchen and hardwood floor and stuff like that with it.
Yeah.
And then when they tap palm wine, it's kind of like a moonshine, not that strong.
Yeah.
And then when the dead palm tree is on the floor, oyster mushrooms grows on it. I mean, it's
really?
Just one tree. Yes.
I had no idea. That's amazing.
Yes. The oyster mushrooms in Ghana grows on the dead palm tree.
Yeah.
And you just go in and forge it, you know. I mean, we have so much, you will not believe it. And yet, African food is nowhere. It's getting better, but we still have a long way to go. We got to promote our food, market it well, and make it look beautiful. I don't have a problem with making it a family thing, because Africa, we eat together and stuff like that. But again, we're trying to target a certain market to present our food. So make it look beautiful. African food can look like any fine dining dish.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious about that. You know, why do you think people are so willing to accept French or Italian food when it's plated in this very fancy, you know, tweezer cuisine, minimal way, but they're kind of confused when they see African food plated like that? Like, why is that such a tension, do you think?
Well, I think because, first of all, they don't know anything about African food.
Yeah.
And we don't promote it well. We don't plate it. We never plated African food like the French or the Italian. So when people see it, they're like, what is this?
Yeah.
You know.
I guess the devil's advocate argument to that is, do you even need to plate African food fancy to get people to care about it? Like, shouldn't it be enough that it's just delicious? Like, why should you need to make Ghanaian food look like French food to get people to eat it? I'm not saying I think that, but that's like an argument you might get, I would imagine.
Yes, a lot of people will say that. But my thing is, how do we get other cultures to taste our food? For me, if you present a food that does not look beautiful, I'm not going to taste it. I don't care where it's from. I'm not. To get me to taste that food, it needs to look neat. You know, you don't want to give somebody a plate and there's extra food on the side and, you know, it looks dirty. And when you say Africa, I'm sorry, but some people automatically think dirt, Ebola, you know, those things. So why are you giving somebody a plate, a white plate with all kinds of messy thing on the plate?
Interesting.
That's just me, because they have this thing, you know, that they've trained your brain to think of Africa in a certain way.
Yeah.
And I know people will not agree with that, but it's the truth. Because I've gone to an event and I show them my dishes and I said, this is African food. And said, no, it's not African food. I said, it's African food. Why is it not African food? We have meat, we have vegetables, we have rice, we have, you know, everything. It's just African food just does not look like what you've seen on the internet or on TV. So you think it's not African food. And we sometimes tend to, especially on the West African side, we eat a lot of spicy food. Pepper hot, like spicy food.
Yeah.
And so when you're cooking for the non-African, sometimes to putting too much pepper in it, sometimes you can't even taste the flavor. So if they are not non-Africans, don't add all that pepper. Because when they taste it, the first thing they know is it's hot, it's spicy. They don't even taste the flavor. So right there, the next time he or she goes somewhere and there's an African food, it's too spicy. You get that?
Yeah.
Because the first time they tried the food, it was too spicy that they couldn't even taste the flavor. So they don't want to try it again. That's another thing.
It sounds like part of what you're saying and part of your philosophy as a chef to me seems like you just know your audience on some level. And if you're trying to appeal to this American audience that's not as familiar with the cuisine, you got to kind of meet them at least halfway, maybe not all the way where they are, but like give them some handhold so they feel comfortable and like, you know, curious enough to try it.
Halfway.
Yeah.
How we run a business.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to target non-Americans. How do you run business out here? When they say they're open at 11 a.m., when you get at 11, it will be opened. Now I'm coming in. I was so embarrassed one time. I was taking my American friend to this restaurant and for lunchtime, they open at 11:30. We got there and it was not open.
This is in Ghana?
Right here in Dallas.
In Dallas. Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So I'm bragging about this dish. We're going in there and it's not even open. And we're standing right there and the owner comes in. And I'm like, okay.
Oh, I see what you mean.
You know what I'm saying? So I know people will hate me for this, but it's the truth. And sometimes the truth hurts. I'm running my business too, and I know how when my Africans come to me, they think I'm running my business in a certain way. I'm not in Africa, I'm here. Mm-hmm. And so I got to run my business this way, you know, and it's a whole talk show.
No, yeah. I appreciate you digging into it with me.
Yeah, but we need to know our target market.
Yeah.
If you're going to be here and you're going to try to target non-Africans, great. Then you can do your business the way you want to do it, like you're still in Africa or whatever. But if you know your target market, then you go out for them. They don't like spicy food. You do not add too much pepper in the food because they will not come back.
Hmm.
And if they try it one time, they will not try it again. And you mess up their whole African food experience with that hot sauce that you gave them.
Hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And make it beautiful. It just, you know, there's a family, you know, you put a whole thing in it, like Thanksgiving. That's different. Yeah. All the dishes are in a big bowl, hipped up and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you trying to do a fine dining, or if you're trying to do a family, but when the customers come in there, they know where they are coming. This is a family style restaurant. I'm not going to expect any plated dessert.
Yeah.
Or a plated dish. That's fine.
Yeah.
It's a buffet. Still make it look presentable. Garnish the buffet line. Garnish it. Make it look beautiful. We eat with our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
If it's beautiful, subconsciously you think it tastes good.
Yeah.
And you dig in it without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
But if it look a hot mess, this food, this is an African food. If it's going to be spicy, I'll just pass.
Yeah.
So that's how I felt. And I know that, you know, African cuisine is evolving. It will get better, but we just have to work hard towards it too. It's better than 7 years ago.
Yeah. Do you mean specifically in terms of representation here in the United States?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's getting better.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that it's obviously an incredibly old, delicious, beautiful, diverse set of cuisines. It's just very under-known in the U.S. Like, you're just coming up against a lot of, and it's changing, but there's a lot of kind of ignorance and maybe misconceptions around what African cuisine is or isn't. Yeah.
A lot. And sometimes even in a competition, you make an African dish and the judges don't have anything to compare because they've not tried an African dish before.
Yeah.
So they're comparing what you did and there's nothing to compare to because they've not tried it before. They've not tried fufu or whatever before. So what are they comparing? Is it good? They don't know. They've not tried fufu before. They don't know if it's good or bad.
Yeah.
You know, they've not tried jollof before, but you know, jollof is similar to the Spanish rice or paella or stuff like that. So in my pop-up, I always put into bracket what the kind of American version is.
Yeah.
You know, I found out that consomme is very similar to the light soup that we eat. So when I have my pop-up and I am having a soup, I have spiced consomme. And I put it into bracket, the light soup. So the non-Americans know that, okay, those people that know consomme know, okay, it's watery, it's light, you know. But for our soup, there's texture in it. But for consomme, you know, you strain it. So I strain my soup because my target is not Africans.
Yeah.
For them to have, you know, soup is supposed to be smooth, to have a mouthfeel, you know,
mm-hmm.
in your mouth. So I strain it. And that's why my customers or my guests, I call them my guests, they get surprised and a lot of them come to my pop-up and they say, you know, we learned something new today. they get surprised. This is African food, the ingredients, the techniques, and the combination. And for my dishes, I like to have at least 5 different textures in there. I like crunchy, creamy, gooey. You have all that in one bite.
Yeah.
You know, it's like taking a journey way to Africa and back. I'll take you there and back in a nice way.
Yeah.
And I serve South African wines and French wines because, you know, we have the Francophone speaking countries. So it's the French and South Africa has the wine. And a lot of people come to my pop-up and they've not tried South African wine. This wine in South Africa, it's amazing. It's delicious. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to market our cuisine and show the continent, show, you know, people what we have on a continent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, in terms of that, like how you interact with your audience and kind of what impression you leave, I'd be curious to hear kind of in closing, what do you want your legacy to be as a chef?
My legacy, I wanted to be one of the chefs that contributed to making fine dining as a, making African cuisine as a fine dining choice.
Awesome. Amazing. I'd love to get to the speed round here. So some quick closer questions for you. First one, is there anything you would encourage folks listening to look into in more depth on their own time?
I want folks listening to try one African food in your lifetime. Cook an African dish. Visit an African restaurant. Taste it. I mean, you can actually just cook it. I have an app on iTunes. There's a bunch of African recipes on YouTube. Just try one and cook a home-cooked meal once a week.
Yeah. Amazing. I mean, just as a little plug on that note, I tried the other weekend finally making Ethiopian infused butter, like a ghee. I think it's called Niter Kibbeh. It's like a Ethiopian butter that you clarify it. So you boil off the water and then you infuse it with like ginger, garlic, cardamom, turmeric, clove, cumin, some chili. And I have to say it honestly didn't even take that long. It took maybe 20, 30 minutes. And it is so delicious. And everything I cook in it is amazing. And I had always thought that those lentils you get at an Ethiopian restaurant are impossible to make at home. It turns out if you have this butter, it's a lot easier. So just to plug to what you said, like try making something outside of your comfort zone. If you haven't cooked anything from Africa, you got to do it. It's a huge world out there, you know?
One time, just try something.
Yeah.
Find like a recipe that has just 5 ingredients or 4 ingredients that you really don't have to go to an African market. You can get it in Whole Food or any regular grocery store and try your hands on something different. And you'd be surprised.
Yeah. Is there one kind of a starter dish you'd recommend for people that's maybe a little bit easier, a little more approachable?
Jollof rice.
Yeah. Amazing.
I'll throw
a recipe in the show notes. What's a positive change you've made in your life in the past year that you think folks should try?
It's funny, but I always watch something funny before going to bed. I started a year and it has changed my mood. I sleep good, you know.
Laughter is important.
Yeah. I make sure I have a good laugh before I say goodnight.
Yeah.
And that has really helped me.
Yeah. And if you're cooking for somebody and you want to make them feel loved, what will you make for them?
Whatever they like. Because I like chocolate and not everybody likes chocolate. I will ask them whatever they like. And I'll cook for them. You come to my house and you end up eating a 3-4 course. You just popping in and you might end up eating a 3 course.
Amazing. Well, if I'm ever in Dallas now, I know who to call.
Please, 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 please do.
Amazing. What a great dinner host to have out there.
Yes.
What ingredient could you not live without?
Salt.
classic chef answer. What's your least favorite thing to waste?
Carrot skin. I don't know why people peel carrots though.
Yeah. If you do peel your carrots, what do you do with the skins?
I make stock with it.
Yeah.
Oh, I add it to a rice. You know, I make little, add it to flour, eggs, make a biscuit out of it. I don't waste carrots.
And what's your go-to karaoke song?
Anything Whitney Houston.
Oh, yeah. She's the best for karaoke, 100%.
Yes.
She also just like for overall like cooking music or doing dishes, it's hard to not have a smile on your face in the kitchen if Whitney Houston's playing.
Yes.
And who's somebody you admire tremendously and what do you admire about them?
My mother.
Mm-hmm.
She was such a good cook. She did not eat salt. She did not eat oil. But I don't know how she got her food to taste so amazing. She uses shrimp to salt her dishes. Hmm. Shrimp.
Wow. That's really cool.
And she's a very giving person. And up to date, she's sick now. She has Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, but she's still giving.
Yeah.
I visit her and she has money under her pillow. And it's like, you need some money, baby? It's amazing. She's been giving her whole life. And even now that she's sick, she still remembers to give. And it's amazing.
Yeah. That's really touching to share. And finally, what are you grateful for this week?
I'm breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really
just breathing.
Poignant note to end on. Kessa Shen, thank you so much for joining us today. Where can people learn more about you and the work that you do?
Well, when you go to kesscravings.com, I'm building a new platform for chefs. I have an online shop. You can buy some of my spices there. You can order cakes. I have some other sauces that will take you all the way to Africa and back.
Amazing. And we'll have links to your website as well as a lot of the stuff we discussed today in our show notes that'll live on our content site, thewholecarrot.com. So head to thewholecarrot.com, get this episode, all the episodes we publish, all the show notes, a lot of fun content there. Definitely check it out when you have a chance. Kes, thank you so much. This has been a really fun conversation.
Thank you.